Copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
Addiction is one huge topic, but it appears with different forms of addictive substances and lifestyles, and there are many common features to those addictions. Whether it's to sex addiction, to drugs, to alcohol, there are going to be common features. So what I'm going to do is give you an overview, which will then be expanded and amplified by the others, hopefully. We're not quite sure how this is going to work ourselves, so we'll see. And to try and help you to think about, again, as we've been talking in the first half, how some of the principles that come out of secular psychology, psychiatry, medicine, Alcoholics Anonymous, how they relate to our biblical worldview, and what within them is valuable and useful, and what we have to be more cautious and careful about. Okay? So this is as I've called it, a bird's eye view, a quick spin. Some images here of addiction that show something of the power of being addicted. Once you're a fish on a hook, you struggle and you struggle and you can't get off. And this Time magazine recognized that you can be addicted to sex, drugs, drinking, smoking, all sorts of things. And it becomes, it affects your brain, it affects your chemicals. Tolkien had a deep understanding, I think, with Gollum, and this idea that something became so important to him that he was not willing, his whole life became organized around his precious. And that's what addictions are for many people, my precious. So in a definition here, which is a rather long one, an overpowering, repetitive, excessive need exists for some substance, object, feeling, act, environment, or personal interaction, and this results in compulsive behavior. So it's not just about a substance necessarily, it may actually be a particular lifestyle. You could become addicted to shopping. We have a struggle to try and work out, you know, what is habit, what is compulsion, what is addiction, what is abuse, what is dependence. We use these words rather interchangeably, but I find it helpful to think of it as a continuum, a slippery slope from bad habits into compulsions. And into dependence and into addiction and abuse. But the words, you'll find the words used in different ways for somewhere on that. But it is this idea of something, you begin to crave something, you're compelled to pursue it, and eventually something that you thought was giving you control over your life comes to control you. So, yeah, in the United States, we've had these categories until recently of substance abuse, where you use something excessively on a regular basis, and then dependence, where it is compulsion and physical need. Now they're moving in the new diagnostic and statistical manual to talk about degrees of dependence, rather than making this distinction. So let's think a little bit about the major substances. One of my themes is that we all live on the edge of addiction. We're not just talking about people who are skid row alcoholics. We're talking about you and me. We all live in some place in our life where we tend to use things, God's good gifts often, in the wrong way, the wrong time, too much. So if you think of the stimulants, we immediately go to Starbucks coffee, and you see the long lines there every morning, for people lining up and people almost shaking as they get to the desk, waiting for their stimulant. Young people start very young in the United States. People drink huge amounts of soda. So they get a lot of sugar, but they also get caffeine at a pretty young age. And then they get into these things. These have 14 times the amount of caffeine as regular soda drinks do. And there are multiple variations of these, aren't there? If you drink coffee, you need to know what sort of coffee you drink. And you can look these things up online, but how it's prepared affects the amount of caffeine, whether you brew it or drip it. And I discovered fairly early on in my coffee drinking days that I'm very sensitive to coffee. A, it keeps me awake a lot at night if I drink too much. But B, my moods do this when I drink a lot of coffee. And I go from, you know, the high and the stimulus of it to a low where I crave it. And then I get up and have another cup. So now I live on a constant infusion of low-caffeine tea, black tea or green tea. I alternate black tea and green tea through there. So I am getting some caffeine, but I think it's a much lower dose. Sometimes I think I should just get off it altogether, but it's an acceptable form. The first time I went into Starbucks, I got such a jolt that I was literally shaking like this afterwards. I had no idea, and the research that's been done on Starbucks shows there's tremendous variety in the amount of caffeine in different places, so anywhere from 250 to 564 milligrams, depending on the Starbucks that you go to and how it's prepared. That's quite a hit. That, by the way, that's a 16-ounce, 500-milliliter cup, not a 250. That's a lot. A lot of people do. You move on to nicotine. Everywhere we go, we see people smoking. This is the figures from the United States, 23% of men, 18% of women. And smoking has come down in the States quite dramatically in recent years, thankfully. And a lot of people in their early 20s are smoking, as you can see here, the 44%, that age group. A third of all smokers make serious attempts to quit each year. 90% resume within a year after making multiple attempts to stop. Really hard to break nicotine. Now, with e-cigarettes that everyone is talking about now, you get quite a shot of nicotine. It's not getting you away from the nicotine. It may be getting you away from some of the carcinogenic effects of the smoke. if you look at the European map, you can see the dark colors are associated with much higher levels of smoking. Interestingly, as we'll see, it parallels alcohol addiction. Alcohol and smoking go together a lot. So nicotine, like most drugs, stimulant drugs, stimulates the brain, but cigarettes kill a huge number of people. So it's not a healthy practice, obviously, to smoke. It may give you that stimulus, but I find it very difficult to believe us when they tell us the number of people that it kills. So if you move on through the other stimulants, we could talk about caffeine, nicotine, amphetamine, meth, which is a huge problem, cocaine in its different forms, glue sniffing, ecstasy. These are popular and everywhere in our culture. We could look at the drugs of neuroenhancement, which amongst college kids, college students in the United States, have become very popular to help them to study, to give them an extra edge. I don't know what the names of these chemicals are in Europe, but you know what I mean, I think. They go beyond caffeine and nicotine to give you the ability to study. And then the number of young men, particularly, and professional athletes, as you know from the scandals in the Olympics and other athletic events, cycling events, who have been caught using various forms of stimulant and anabolic steroids for to enhance their bodies and their strength and their endurance. So there are the stimulants. Then the other broad category we talk about are the depressants. This is whether they stimulate your nervous system or depress your nervous system. So alcohol, the most popular, and we'll talk more about that later, does give you a good feeling of relaxation and makes you perhaps more talkative and so on at first, but it is depressing your central nervous system. So in the United States, 23% of the population admit to binge drinking, having, you know, weekends where they drink 2 or 3 days, and then they might not drink anything in between. But the college students, the 18 to 25 year olds, do a lot of binge drinking. And of course, in the United States, they may start that earlier because the legal age for drinking is higher than in most of Europe. But 7% of the population are the ones who do all the heavy drinking. They're the ones who consume most of the alcohol. and again, the 18 to 25 year olds. There's an old movie, which I think is a very powerful movie in relation to this, called When a Man Loves a Woman. Do you know that movie? Yeah. It gives you a very good depiction of how alcohol takes over, and that's what we'll talk about more this afternoon. Now, when we talk about alcohol, obviously in the media we hear quite a lot about the benefits of drinking a little bit of alcohol, and it's true, a small amount is not bad for you. One drink a day, they claim, gives you less risk of heart disease or stroke, reduces your bad cholesterol. But for women, more than half a drink a day increases their risk of breast cancer. So you are juggling the benefits and the risks with this. And of course, women are much more easily addicted because their metabolism is different. So they cannot drink as much as men can. And they tend to get drunk more quickly, become addicted more easily. So the progression, and this is something that we'll talk about several times in different ways, I'm sure, with alcohol, is usually this: people starting with the casual, social, normal consumption of alcohol, and then going on to excessive amounts, very often in people who may be shy and find relationships difficult, and they use it to ease their ability to talk in social situations, in parties, and out at the pub. And a few of them will be binge drinkers. But then you gradually have that growing anticipation of the welcome effect of the chemical. My wife and I quite often have a glass of wine at the end of the day, and I can feel at times that growing anticipation as I drive home, you know, of the relaxing effect and the pleasant scent and taste. And I have to watch myself. I have to be careful. We have said to ourselves, every so often we will fast from alcohol, just to test. And I can feel the craving in that first day or two of how easy it is to become both psychologically and physically dependent on it in those very early stages. And then you develop this growing rigidity. You have to have the drink. My wife grew up in a pretty typical upper middle class background in the States, and every day at clockwork at 6 p.m. there would be drinks, and this would be liquor, and that was part of the culture, and all her parents' friends did it. It became a ritual for these people. And then you gradually develop the physical tolerance and obviously need more ingenuity, more of the substance to get the effect. Another movie, by the way, that has come up recently that I actually haven't seen yet, but I'm told is a really good depiction of addiction, is the movie Flight. Have any of you seen that? If you're afraid of flying, I'm told don't watch it. But it's about a pilot, Denzel Washington, who is a pilot who is an alcoholic. So the ways we talk about addiction in this overview are: you need more of the substance to give you the same effect. That's what we call the building up of tolerance. Your body gets used to it, and you experience withdrawal effects when you're away from it. You take more and you take it for longer than you intended to, and you begin to deceive yourself. You know, just one more drink. You want to cut down, but you find it very difficult to cut down. And you spend more time under the influence. And then it begins to take over your life, so you begin to give up getting exercise or other activities that you might do with your children, and you spend more time in the pursuit of or around people who are using the drug or drinking. And then the final bit is you continue to do it despite knowing that it is harmful to you, your body, your brain, your children, your wife, your marriage, your career. That's a really critical thing. And you begin to, obviously, to deceive yourself. So we'll have more of that in all of the sessions, I'm sure. Then the other, so beyond the alcohol, the other depressants, the downers, are what we call the sedative hypnotics, things like barbiturates and Valium, and sleeping pills of different forms. These are all pretty addictive, both psychologically and physically. And they are frequently prescribed very liberally as if they weren't addictive. Something like Valium is widely prescribed. And sleeping pills. I find that I can get hooked on sleeping pills very quickly. Within a few days, my brain is dependent on them. And I have to be very careful not to. If I'm going through a time when I'm very anxious or jet lagging or sometimes I use them, but I have to be careful to how I use them. And then you get on into the heavier stuff with the opioids, the narcotics, things like heroin and cocaine and crack. And another movie to mention here is the movie Ray, the blind pianist, black guy in the States. It's a very powerful movie in relation to the destructive effects of both alcohol and marijuana and heroin, arising from his childhood feeling of responsibility for his brother's death, which leaves him vulnerable, I think, to this, and his blindness, which he has to deal with, and his eventual recovery from that. And then painkillers are a huge problem with addiction in the United States. I don't know whether it's the same here, but people who are using painkillers for some chronic illnesses, maybe for a while, and then they don't stop them, and they become hooked on, especially OxyContin. I don't know what name that would be here. And then the hallucinogens sort of almost come in a category of their own. Marijuana is often put in this category, and you know that in the United States now, a number of states have legalized marijuana for medical use and some for recreational use. And there is huge debate because a lot of people are saying it's no worse than alcohol. Alcohol is bad for you, but marijuana, they would say, isn't as bad for you as alcohol. So if we can have alcohol, why not? And then they debate the harmful effects of it. I think there is quite a lot of good research that suggests that for long-term use, and especially in young people, there is it does affect the brain. So there is a deterioration of memory and learning and processing of information. But many people use it to medicate depression and anxiety, and many use it socially. And then LSD and mescaline, which may not be very addictive, but certainly are used. And so often people use a cocktail of different of alcohol, sedatives, hypnotics, smoking, a whole lot of different things. So what we're seeing here is a common path of dopamine release. Here's the sort of neurological biochemical thing, the beginning of that, the dopamine release in the pleasure centers of the brain. And it's estimated that the biochemical effect, certainly of alcohol on the brain, about 40% of that is inherited. So that you do have a genetic predisposition to the way in which alcohol affects you. And some people, it doesn't affect them at all. And some people in some Asian countries cannot drink alcohol at all because it has such a profoundly negative effect on them. And others are somewhere in between. Some people will find they need more stimulus from the alcohol to get the same pleasure. So for most people, they are using... We tend to use more when we are stressed, don't we? If I'm having difficulty at work and I come home stressed every night, my wife's having difficulty at work and our children are in trouble, then we tend to want to calm ourselves, relax ourselves more, and find ways to do that, to reduce the pain and find pleasure. And people who have come from a background of chronic stress in early childhood tend to be more vulnerable. You haven't maybe learned well how to deal with stress. I think we've said most of these things here. But you may use it so not only just to get pleasure, but to avoid feeling bad, so that you can sleep at night, so you can get up in the morning, so you can face the day, so that you can avoid anxiety, stop the shakes. Whatever it is. And your brain becomes used to this. It's rewired. The pathways, the chemicals are changed so that now you are... your brain is working in a different way. Now with drugs and alcohol, it's interesting that you can be physically dependent but not psychologically addicted. There are a lot of Vietnam vets who came back from Vietnam who were detoxed from heroin use. They were using it partly because of the stress there, and because everyone else was using it, and to help them to get into battle. And if they were in pain, they also used it. But apparently, after they came back from Vietnam, 90% of them never used heroin again. That's a huge number to get off it. So only 10% then were truly long-term addicts. There was a temporary relief in Vietnam, but they didn't need it when they got home. Now, of course, many Vietnam vets and Iraq and Afghanistan vets are suffering from severe post-traumatic stress disorder and are still using alcohol and drugs, other forms of addiction, to deal with the PTSD. So that sort of overview of the substances. And then we talk about addiction. Some people call it process addictions or lifestyle addictions. To shopping, you hear of people, you know, who have 500 pairs of shoes in their closet, in their cupboard. When they get stressed, what do? They go out shopping. It may be to shopping, to gambling, to the internet, to sex addiction that we'll talk about, to food. We have a huge problem in the United States, as you know, with obesity, and with people being overweight. And that's partly because we are not a walking culture in the way that you are. People just don't walk, they drive everywhere. not surprisingly, they get very little exercise, and partly because everything is mega-sized at all the fast food outlets, and it's particularly the poorer people who are vulnerable to this, who cannot afford the more expensive, healthy foods. And we have to eat to live. So there are some things that we get addicted to that are good gifts of God's creation, and some things that we use and create, like meth and heroin and so on, that we put into our bodies that you don't have to have. In obesity, the average weight in America has gone up 26 pounds. I should have it in kilograms for you, shouldn't I? 30 kilograms, yeah? Since 1960. So 33% of the population are categorized as obese. 33% overweight. And the other 33% are okay. it's estimated that 90% of obesity is food addiction. 10% may be a metabolic disorder. So you need to be careful in terms of how you deal with people in this way. But there is a strong genetic predisposition. So if you have a family history of a lot of obesity, it may be partly genetic, partly the way your family eat, and partly some of the psychological stress factors that are there in dysfunctional families. I mean, I know I eat. When I arrived in the United States 22 years ago, I'm not typically someone who is addictive in my patterns of eating and drinking. You can hear I could easily drink too much, I could easily eat too much, but I got absolutely obsessed with eating donuts. It was ironic, it was sort of like this ring, this thing with a hole in the middle. I was trying to fill the hole in my soul of grief and emptiness and sadness and pain. I just felt I had this literal hole right here of having lost so much of what I knew and trying to get used to this culture. So on my drive to work, I could feel the car just veering off the route. And I couldn't control the wheel as it went. It lasted about 6 months, and then it faded away again as I grieved and got used to living in that alien country. But we know that, you know, all the research and all the documentaries and the movies that are coming out on food in the United States and how much chemical goes into the food that is not good for you, and how much sugar and salt and fat, which actually rewires your brain and makes you dependent on those particular things. Teaching people to eat, I think, is a big... I think you should all be expert nutritionists as counselors, because it makes people depressed, it makes them anxious. Every part of your brain is affected by what you eat and what you drink. So you need to be knowledgeable about those things. and when people are stressed, they tend to crave fat and sugar, just like I did with those donuts. And then we have the other process. Lifestyle addiction, of course, is sex. You can't do without food. If you're married, it's unlikely that you're going to be able to live without sex. And nowadays, of course, most single people in our culture can't think of living without sex and think that we Christians are crazy to imagine you could be celibate. But pornography addiction, just briefly, and Glenn and others are going to go into that a little bit later. You know, it's partly because real relationships are difficult, aren't they? And it's much easier to go for your quick fix to alcohol or to drugs or to masturbation with pornography to give you a good feeling rather than to work at relationships. So you have more sense of control. Relationships feel out of control. I can't control whether my wife wants to have a sexual relationship with me. She may not feel like it. All sorts of stresses may get in the way. But I can control the images I watch on the internet. But eventually, it controls you. And the orgasm is very addictive. It's a powerful chemical release in your body. And if you, as a young man or young woman, have got used to channeling your emotions, your anxiety, your depression through masturbation and release, then how easy it is to get hooked on that. It numbs your pain, it alters your mood, and people are more vulnerable to sexual addiction and to all addictions in general if they have a history or family history of abuse or family dysfunction that leaves you feeling worthless and unlovable and alone. These are the holes in the soul that you try and fill with making yourself feel good in this artificial way. So shopping, pornography, gambling. In one study of 222 pathological gamblers, 65% said that refraining from betting gave them withdrawal symptoms like insomnia, headaches, upset stomach, even sweating and chills. So there's something about the way in which your chemistry, your brain chemistry, is changed by this particular habit of repetitively gambling. And we could go on. Work. People become workaholics, don't they? If you can't relax at the weekend and stop thinking about work, if you can't stop to play with your children, but you're always... And here we get into that. Everyone, you know, you see parents at the playground. They're doing their work while they're playing with their kids at the playground. They're doing something else. So it's a ubiquitous problem everywhere we go. Computer games, video games, television, the amount of television. You know, it's very easy again when you come home from work to switch on the television and just relax. And I need something mindless. We often say, I'm stressed out and I just have to watch my favorite program. But then the amount of hours you spend, they gradually creep up and you find yourself spending more and more time finding more and more important programs that you have to watch. And the same on the internet. You spend hours surfing the internet. YouTube addiction. You know, you could do it forever, couldn't you? There's just everything is out there. And most of us are sort of bored with life in general. And so we surf the web, the internet, movies, sport. People don't just watch one movie a night. They watch three movies in a night. I found teenagers will rent, we'll get two or three movies to watch. And they don't actually talk about them or watch them. It's all entertainment, isn't it? It's mindless entertainment rather than actually engaging, thinking about the messages that you're getting. Sport. How many marriages are destroyed by husband's addiction to sport or to television, and watching sport on television. And then there are those of us, rare mortals, who only feel alive when they are screaming towards Earth in this sort of way, or doing this sort of thing. And these people talk about what they do in this addictive way. And they will... there was a guy who was killed on Mount Everest a while back, and he phoned his wife and kids from Mount Everest before he died. But he persisted on mountain climbing, dangerous mountains, after he had a young family, knowing that he might lose his life. That sounds to me like an addiction. So there are good things that you can be addicted to, dangerous adrenaline junkies. It may be surfing the big waves, whatever it is. But can we talk, therefore, about positive and negative addictions? Are there some things that, or do we just talk about good habits? You know, I find that exercise is really important to me for my sanity, especially at my age. I have to keep my brain going somehow. So to go for a run or to go to the gym or to do some Pilates or something, most days is really important. And I'm getting antsy because I didn't get a chance to go for a run yesterday. But I am sort of addicted to the high it gives me. Now, is that an addiction or is it just a good habit? Well, I would suggest to you that it is, you know, if I spent days training for marathons regularly and wasn't able to spend time with my wife or my grandkids, then it is becoming something that is dangerous. Glyn loves fly fishing, and some of you may too, and it can be pretty addictive. You could spend hours away from your family, and if life is difficult in your marriage, why not? That's you on the right there. I grew up in sailing families, and my wife did too. And I have often been tempted to go off around the world and give up working. But, you know, what would that do to my marriage and to my family? There are addicted sailors. They're good things. It's a wonderful thing to do, and I love it. That's my wife at the helm there, at the back. But the central theme, I think, in addiction is some sort of escape from painful feelings and thought and reality. You're trying to escape, trying to avoid uncomfortable emotions. There's one Harvard psychiatrist, Dr. Dodas, who focuses on rage. He says rage is at the heart of every addiction. And what he means is it's rage at being helpless in the face of emotions that you cannot control. Whether it's envy, whether it's frustration in your marriage at not getting enough sex, whether it's rage at your boss at your work or at your parents for the way they treated you. But I think there's a lot of truth in some of that. It gives you an illusion of control and power and hope, but actually then eventually destroys that. So I come back to this theme of do you see yourselves living on the edge of addiction as we talk like this? Do you think is it fair for us to use the language that we are all living on the edge of addiction? What do you think? Skip Facebook. Exactly. We're all addicted to something in some way, yeah. I mean, we could say, I mean, the Bible's diagnosis, we're addicted to sin. But it is, all of these things are forms of that, aren't they? They're the surface of that. Flirting with addiction. Oh, sorry, I thought you said flirting is an addiction. Flirting with, yeah, that's right, I think we do. And then we get sucked in. But it's true. But that's where we'll come back to, I'm sure, later, that spiritual disciplines are a really helpful thing to check yourself. You know, fasting, in a way, is saying, what am I dependent on? Most of us can't live without eating for a day, and it really tests us when you try not to. Can you live without alcohol for a week? Yeah, so this is a question about self-harm in young people particularly, and is there an addictive quality to that? And so when a young person cuts themselves, such as
hair pulling,
so there are various elements, aren't there, in self-harm of just wanting to feel alive, feel something when they feel numb. That may be a part of it. Some of them are using it to punish because they feel a lot of shame and guilt. For some of them, it may... Here we get into the area of obsessive-compulsive disorder. And what's the difference between addiction and obsessive-compulsive behavior? That's another area that maybe we need to discuss a bit. But Glenn... But you're highlighting here the how we use the word addiction, whether it's just a much too big a concept, or whether it just comes down to a narrowly defined neurochemical change that we can identify. And can I ask you, do you think I'm using it, as I talk about it now, too widely?
Well, no, I think the point I'm making is some certainly would.
Some certainly would say that I am using it too widely.
Yeah, that we cast it so wide.
I mean, I think the things typically that we point to as the hallmarks are this idea of tolerance, that you need more and more of the substance, the alcohol, the behavior. The sex needs to be more and more dramatic to give you the same response, which is a behavioral and a neurochemical response too in your brain. Now, with cutting, you know, there might not be any escalation, so that you need to do more and more and more dramatic things. It may stay exactly the same, but there often is an increase in what they do. Okay, so that's where it's moving into, and it has an addictive quality to it. This idea of withdrawal symptoms, that you get very restless and anxious and have physical withdrawal, so that your body has become dependent, like these gamblers that I mentioned, is another one. I think the idea where it comes to control you, so that you continue to do it, even though you know that it is actually harming you or your family or your marriage. I think those are some of the core things.
Is it?
Yeah. Withdrawal.
Some level of harm.
Harm. And denial of harm.
Maybe also like where it comes from. Is it more compulsion? Because I had some clients who were harming themselves, and it felt more like an external, like something I have to do. It wasn't something self-chosen. In a sense, like, whereas alcohol, most of these addictions are first, they do it to enjoy, and not, and no.
Right.
There might be something in there between compulsion and addiction.
That's hard, isn't it? Because as it comes to control you, you feel it like a compulsion. With obsessive compulsive disorder, we often say this is something that you feel compelled to do, even though you don't want to.
Yeah. The resistance is the pain.
The resistance is the pain
in compulsion. I like what Glyn said, because if everything is treated as addiction, then the word addiction will lose its seriousness. And we have a tendency to use, like, there used to be the term codependency. Now everybody's immune to the word. We treat it like no big deal because we are codependent of everything. And if we treat dependency like this, addiction like that, there is a danger that it will. We become immune to the word, and it will be harder to warn people with the word. You know, have you thought about that? Maybe you are addicted. Reconsider your actions and your way of life.
Mm-hmm. If we talk about it as, is it okay? Do you think to talk about it as a slippery slope into addiction, where it actually becomes addiction? Is where you have these three particular signs. And sex addiction, you know, when you look at the figures, the experts like Patrick Carnes would say only 8% of men are addicted to sex and 3% of women. But many people, 50% of men in the United States, feel that they are compelled to go to pornography. Are they addicted? But Patrick Carnes, is using very narrow criteria for addiction. I want to move on a little further, and then maybe, hopefully, we'll have time at the end for other comments or questions. Yeah, so that's a question we're going to have to look at as we go along, of is there a difference between the way we help Christians and non-Christians? Because we know the ultimate solution is depending upon God. If we think about addiction, the word addiction is not used in Scripture, okay? But there are other parallel concepts here that I think are there. This idea that in Genesis chapter 4, where Cain and Abel are told to bring sacrifices, and Abel brings the right sacrifice, and Cain does not. He wants to do it his own way, is the implication. And God says to Cain, you know what's right, you know, I'm going to give you another chance, but if you do not do what is right, sin is waiting at the door to, as it were, capture you. It's this image of sort of the beast waiting outside the door to grab. If you keep giving in to your own way, then this nebulous thing called sin will grab you, maybe the devil, sin itself, your sinful nature. The second one is this idea of having disordered desires. As a result of the fall, being sinful people, our desires are mixed up. We have a mixture of dignity and depravity. So that Paul says in Romans 7, so I find this law at work when I want to do good, evil is right there with me. For in my inner being I delight in God's law, but I see another law at work in my body, waging war against the law of my mind and making me a prisoner to the law of sin at work within my members. What a wretched man I am. Who will deliver me from this body of death? So we, as even as believers, we have this old nature which we are exhorted to put to death, that the Spirit of God is working to destroy within us, that one day will be completely destroyed, that we will be completely free from. But now there is this tussle within us, this inner battle. Another image, I think, that goes along this idea of addiction is that of adultery, of spiritual adultery, that is described in Ezekiel, of people going off after other lovers. Something else will satisfy you, give you the deepest pleasure that you're looking for. In Proverbs 1 to 11 talks about, you know, which voice are you going to listen to? Are you going to follow the voice of foolishness and folly, or are you going to listen to the voice of wisdom? And it's sort of like a seductive picture of a seductive woman who's luring you away from the wisdom of God. And then the last one, that of idolatry. You could talk about addiction as being a disorder of worship. You're worshiping the wrong thing. You're not worshiping the true God. And in Ezekiel, it talks about the elders of Israel worshiping the true God, but also worshiping other idols. So you can be a believer, but you can have little idols that become really important to you, that actually become more important than the true God. So idolatry, I think, so as we explore the heart, we need perhaps to use some of these. I think a lot of our work in Christian counseling is connecting the common language, popular language of addiction and psychology, and so pop psychology, professional psychology, is connecting it with biblical language. It's like sort of a translation exercise, because people know that what they hear in church, they know what they hear in sermons, but how do they relate that to what they hear from the psychologist? So that's a lot of our work, I think, is doing that. I sort of created a diagram trying to put together a lot of these things. I hope some of it's difficult to see there. But when you're dealing with addiction, you're dealing with the heart problems, which are the problems of that have arisen often through early childhood brokenness of family dysfunction and abuse, maybe sexual abuse, addicted parents, maybe people who've had PTSD, a lot of grief, a lot of stress, loneliness, anxiety, shame, meaninglessness. These are all the sort of the background things of life that cause us, how we deal with those in our heart is absolutely critical, isn't it? And that's a lot of what the Bible is talking about.
Do you use the heart here in that Old Testament sense?
Thank you.
Of being the
yes.
Center?
Good question. Do I use the heart in the Old Testament sense, the Hebrew sense of being the core of your being? And by heart, it means your thinking, feeling. We use it commonly in your mind and your heart. I mean your mind and your emotions, your thinking and your feeling capacity. So the ways you think about life, the way you ways you respond to it. But then we also have the changes that go on in the brain that we have to deal with. That once you have put certain things in your brain for long enough, you're poisoning your brain, you're changing its pathways. Once you have done certain things for long enough, like sexual addiction, you actually change the very structure and the chemicals in the brain. So you have to retrain the brain in various disciplined ways. And we live in an instant gratification culture which wants pleasure and doesn't want pain. And a lot of people have found that emotional intelligence is linked very strongly with the ability to delay gratification. People who are emotionally intelligent can put off pleasure for much longer, and that affects all sorts of areas of your life when you can do that for good. And then, of course, the availability, the choices that you make, and the behavioral cycle you need to deal with, where, you know, what do you do? What do you do with your computer when you know you are addicted to pornography? What blocks do you have to put on it? What do you do with the alcohol when you are addicted to alcohol? How does it change your life in terms of where you go and what you do? So there are a lot of behavioral things that we have to work on in coaching, helping people in that area. So these are some of the, just repeating that in another form, as we move into helping people to heal, you're dealing with how do you numb pain? How do you deal with legitimate longings for love, for affirmation, for acceptance by other people, for freedom from anxiety? How do you deal with that in the wrong ways? These are the heart issues that you're dealing with a lot. What about the behavior and thought life battles? You know, when you get anxious or feel shame and your immediate thought is to go to look up images on your computer, sexually stimulating images. How are you going to deal with those behavior thought life battles? How do you retrain your brain in this way? And we're learning, as I said in the first session, a lot more about how to retrain the brain. And then a very critical thing that all programs dealing with addiction, whether it's sex addiction or alcohol addiction, and you're going to tell us more about the 12 steps, is community. You have to come out of your hidden secret world with somebody and other people to confess and to be open, to live in a community where you will not experience the same level of shame that drives you back into the addictive cycle. So you're dealing with shame and guilt and fear, and then learning healthy lifestyle, nutrition, good food, exercise, all of these things to, again, tune up your brain so that you're not so vulnerable, to repair the damage that you have done to your body and your brain in this sort of way. And Jesus teaches in John 8 that if you hold to my teaching, he says, you are really my disciples. And then you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. Everyone who sins is a slave to sin. If the Son sets you free, you will be free indeed. So this idea of slavery to sin, and once you have a new master, once you give yourself to Christ, then in a sense you become his servant. And you're motivated not then by fear, but by love, by his grace, to serve him and to do what is right. And then as you progressively do more and more of what is good, you live by the Maker's instructions, you feel that growing sense of freedom. He has sent me to bind up the brokenhearted. And here is our mission, to proclaim freedom for the captives and release for the prisoners. So captives to sin. I mean, I think we can talk about sin as we are slaves to it, aren't we, in all forms. Whether you use the, in a sense, we're addicted to it because we keep returning to it. And we tend to want, you know, once you give yourself to something, you want more and more of it. So there is some relevance to talking about it in that way. So other questions, comments out of that? Richard, so you're saying that would be another mark of addiction, not just for the pleasure, but it's to avoid the pain of not having it, of the withdrawal symptoms. Yeah, I think that goes along with the withdrawal part of it. That's the reason why you need it, and that certainly is a mark of addiction. Yeah. Ephesians 4:17-19, and read it backwards. So that the darkened understanding, the hardness of heart, I mean, as we turn away from the ways we know we should live, then we often lose true sensitivity, and we want sensuality. We want the appetites of the flesh to be indulged. Yeah, feel the fullness, yeah. Yeah, no, that's true. I think that's very appropriate for food or for sex particularly, or any other comments or questions. So learning to, that's a great point, learning to rest, learning to have a Sabbath. And in a way, it's slowing down enough so that you're not frenetically always trying to seek for something to still your mind, a chemical or an active lifestyle way. You have to learn to stop and be comfortable just being yourself, don't you? Which for many people is really, really hard, because when you confront yourself, all your demons come up. And you don't like it, and you want to put them down again. So actually, but I think you're right, and I think a Sabbath is part of a good discipline in life that the Lord has said is good for us. And a Sabbath is not just a don't have any fun, is it? I think it's much more a day when you celebrate the whole creation, as well as you learn from Scripture and you worship with others. But you can do things that actually are glorying in the world that God has given you. So you're saying in therapy that you do, the fuel is finding the things that are under the surface, the heart problems, right? And you're wondering is there anyone who gets addicted without that, without those things that may fuel it? So the addiction is not so much the problem, but a symptom of a deeper problem. What do you think, you guys who are experts, who have experience in this? Have you met people who are addicted who... I mean, does anyone not have a heart problem anyway? That's the difficulty. The push-pull factors that you're talking about, and some substances are so addictive that they don't actually need all these underlying heart problems. But the thought that comes into my mind as you say that is that there are a lot of people, you know... What is it? It's about 10% of people who actually get addicted out of the users of many different substances, whether they use crack once, or alcohol, or other thing, or sexual addiction. We're talking about a small proportion who actually become addicted. Those are the ones who tend to have the vulnerability factors under the surface in strong measure. They have a lot of them.
Down your syndrome definition, then,
yes.
You are coming back to three, you know, hallmarks.
Right, right. But that doesn't mean that the others may not be... And this is where you have this thing of the idea of abuse and dependence,
yeah,
and addiction. That this there is a continuum there. Yeah. Yes.
A very important factor is also the attitude of the heart. because especially with pornography and sexual addictions, many times it's the instant gratification and no conviction of the heart that will not bring us to self-control. And we are in a nation when we have to be gratified right away. In the minute we have a desire or an emotion, it has to be taken care of right away. Mm-hmm. I mean, with the McDonald's drive-thru, I think it's a great example of the emotional drive-thru that we're living in.
Yeah, well, that's a great comment. The emotional drive-thru. That was my donuts, the emotional drive-thru. Yeah. Yeah, Yelena.
I find it interesting, very often, that they will, when you want to take something that they're addicted to, that they will feel that that's where they're, that's something that I find pleasure, fulfillment. That's something that, Yeah, that's something that I enjoy. And very often when I ask them, what does it bring you pleasure? What is the time? I mean, all the healthy eating and living healthy and stopping in life, then they don't know what to do. And for them, fulfilling and joy is addiction. Like, this is what I do for myself. And they're afraid if they lose that, that they are going to be empty, that they are going to be unfulfilled. Why do I? So, I mean, teaching them in the same way, so, well, if you kind of lose this, what do you do? What is instead, what do you integrate in your life that gives you joy, pleasure, fulfillment?
Right, right.
Because you can't just take away something that is like, then you they end up with a hole and they need donuts.
Right. No, I mean, it is asking the question of the things that you're meeting that particular need in this particular way. How could you meet it in other ways that are actually healthier for you?
Yeah.
But because it's not necessarily a bad need. Mm-hmm. It's a God-given longing.
Yes.
But you're meeting it in the wrong way and in the wrong amount.